I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we're going to talk about what the political and public policy landscapes in Indiana and in America will look like under a new governor and in the second Obama administration. We will look at what the challenges before Hoosiers and Americans are and how likely it is that elected officials will meet those challenges. We'll discuss all of this with a great group of guests: Indiana Public Policy Institute Director John Krause, Dave Dressler of the University of Indianapolis' CEL program, and Brian Payne, President and CEO of the Central Indiana Community Foundation. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, Executive Editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Indiana under a new Pence administration and a second Obama administration. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I am fortunate to have a great group of guests today. John Krause, who is the director of the Indiana Public Policy Institute. John, welcome back to the program.
Oh, nice to be here.
It's good to have you here. Dave Dressler, who is the head of the Center of Excellence in Leadership of Learning at the University of Indianapolis. Dave, welcome to the program.
You got that exactly right.
I'm glad
to be here.
I'll try not to say that often, or we won't have that much time to talk. And Brian Payne, welcome back to the program. Brian's president and CEO of the Central Indiana Community Foundation.
Thanks. It's nice to be here as well.
Well, I think we've got our news hook to get this conversation started in that, right now we've had this weird dynamic of Congress arriving at a deal to avoid a fiscal cliff that they helped to devise themselves. And at first there's euphoria that they managed to avert disaster, and now members of both parties are running to as many microphones as they can find, claiming how much, all of them saying how much they hate the deal that they just struck. So I guess where I would like to start this conversation, at least at the national level, is are things likely to stay what seems to any rational observer to be this dysfunctional and for the foreseeable future? I'll start with John Krause on that one.
I think this is a three-act play. It's a Greek tragedy, or it's waiting for the fat lady to sing, or all of the above. It's going to continue. I had a member of Congress who's a sitting member today, I won't identify, in my law school class in mediation. And I ran into him a couple months ago, and I said, well, you know, you learned a lot in the class, but you're not practicing a lot in Washington, D.C. And it is totally dysfunctional. I think we had a short sigh of relief in having the tax measures pass, but the next thing is the debt limit. And I think no one wants the other side to win any points. And one of the things that I think is lacking in all this is anyone appreciating the true sense of what we're doing, and that is governance.
Mm-hmm.
We have a country to run and to be competitive, and we are just wallowing in partisan politics on each side.
Yes. Dave Dressler, are things likely to get any better?
Well, I think it's ironic that this fiscal cliff was designed to be onerous enough that not even Congress would back off of approving the debt limit. And now that the debt limit is coming back in just a couple months, there will be another, the next act of this play. And I think John is quite right. I think it's all about scoring points and winning and losing, and it's not about public policy or serving the population.
Well, I'll reframe it ever so slightly for Brian Payne here. What is the cause? I think so far we've gotten a consensus, and I'll let you say yes or no. Do you see the dynamic there is dysfunctional? the answer is yes, then, you know, what's the cost
well,
to the community and to the country?
Yeah, well, I'm an optimist. I mean, I'm always an optimist. But, you know, and what I've been struck about so many things is how quickly things can change in anything these days. I mean, change is so fast.
Mm-hmm.
So something could change. I think we're probably in for another tough year of dysfunction. But I would think that maybe 2014, I'm optimistic that maybe some of the dysfunction starts to go away. The cost is, and we've seen this in philanthropy,
mm-hmm.
when you don't have stability, when you don't have any sense of where something is going, what direction the country's, I mean, we do have a sense of the country's going in a bad direction, but when there's all this unknown, people don't act.
Mm-hmm.
I had donors tell me, though we actually did have a good fourth quarter, ultimately, at the Central Indiana Community Foundation, there was money flowing mm-hmm. back into the system, into new philanthropic funds. We were very thrilled about that. But I did have some donors who just said, you know what, until the fiscal cliff gets worked out, which, you know, wasn't until after December 31st in the kind of the big giving season,
mm-hmm.
We're just not doing anything. I mean, people won't make a decision to put $1 million in a philanthropic fund, even if they're extremely wealthy, if they don't know what tomorrow's going to be like, or they don't have a sense of confidence. And I think what's happened is, and that same with business, same with philanthropy, is our dysfunction in government has eroded a sense of our confidence. And so often then, that means inaction. We're waiting to see what happens before you do anything proactive. And that's the cost of it to me, is that so many businesses, so many potential philanthropists are still waiting for clarity that hasn't come the last two or three years.
We're growing
John
a generation
Cross, yeah,
of new leaders, or those that we hope would be leaders, that have a rather jaded, if not suspicious, view of the role of government and the role of governance. And I think it is exacerbated by the fact that you can turn on soundbite media, mm-hmm. Whatever it is, and hear someone screaming some opinion at you, and you don't really get any time to have any thought and analysis about it, and that's what you go with because it's the last thought you heard. I hate to be, you know, so casting of dispersions on all this, because I think there's pockets of leadership, and I think that's what you're seeing maybe on a local and a state level, more so on the national level.
Well, and I want to talk about that, move the conversation shortly here to what we can expect, but how much of this also ends up being kind of a public or citizen's responsibility? I mean, John Krauss just alluded to the fact that we've grown this generation of leaders who have a jaded view of government, but we've grown them for a couple of generations to some degree. And, you know, it seems like one of the things as a longtime political observer that I've noticed is, to me, the fundamental absurdity of someone who has been serving in public office for 20, 25, 30 years, running as an anti-government candidate, you know, indicting the very system that he or she helped to create. Dave Dressler, how much of that is a disconnect on the public's part?
Well, the public returns the legislators to their offices. Incumbency is a pretty powerful measure of their future. What's happened, I think, is that compromise has become a dirty word in Washington. And if you compromise, that means you compromise your principles. That means you have no principles. And so people tend to stake out extreme positions and then not adjust those positions based on the public good or what compromise might bring the country, but instead are willing to see the country go over the fiscal cliff. You know, there were a lot of people that were hoping that it would go over the fiscal cliff, which would prove their point. And that kind of an extreme position is, I think, irresponsible. And it's that level of irresponsibility that frustrates the populace.
Yeah, the equivalent of.
But I don't want to look as though I'm siding with this total dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes by taking extreme position and kind of bunker mentality, that gives someone a whole lot of safety. And as Brian was saying, there has changed so much about us, and the economic conditions and unemployment and things like that, or not knowing the future as maybe people thought from the good old days they'd be able to do it. So people are seeing some safety in this position. I know it, so I'm going to defend it until because if they take that away from me, then I have no more certainty, and that's the kind of the last thing I have. It's unfortunate. I mean, you look for the basic elements of conflict resolution, and we're just going through this battle of positional bargaining. Mm-hmm. You know, it's my position, I want it, and I want to win, rather than understanding there are common interests and there's common needs.
We are talking about the political and public policy landscape here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can shoot an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, we focused a lot of the discussion here on the national level, but we've seen some of the same sort of breakdowns even here at the state level. I mean, over the past couple of years, we've seen state government shut down over right to work. Obviously, you know, that's not possible now with the supermajorities in both the House and the Senate, but there is that sort of winner-take-all mentality here, and that this is not about, you know, resolving differences for the greater common good as much as it is, you know, gaining the greatest partisan advantage in the time in which you hold the reins of power. Brian Payne, I see you nodding your head here. Is that disturbing to you?
Well, it is disturbing, and kind of going back to the earlier conversation about nationally, I think the public is to blame. I mean, ultimately, you know, the public is what, you know, we celebrate as a general public, you know, what the media gives us. In fact, you know, like CNN, I mean, it says, you know, I read an article earlier this year that lambasted CNN because it's lost its way and its ratings are way down. Well, why did it, and then what it say, how did it lose its way? Is because it didn't have its niche audience like MSNBC with the liberals or Fox with the conservatives. So it actually was being lambasted as a failed concept because
for
it didn't
adhere to traditional journalistic principles.
Yeah. Yeah. Which at the same time, you know, others in the media would say, we've lost our traditional journalistic principles. At the same time, someone who was trying to adhere to them lost their audience, and you know, and then they get lambasted. So it's our culture is so extremist and celebrating and defining instantly winners and losers. And, you know, and so it's harder to have principles and stay to your principles when the rest of the world is calling you a loser for doing so. Anyway, I just think that our whole culture has become extreme in that way, and that creates a disservice, and it creates a battle of winning and losing instead of governing.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Joseph who says, my wife is an elementary level art teacher in her second year with Indianapolis Public Schools. Under the Mitch Daniels, Tony Bennett education plan, we continually worry that her job and the jobs of other public school teachers will be in jeopardy every year. The most recent reform will allow anyone with a bachelor's degree who passes a test to teach in a public school. No licenses, no training on how to deal with children or discipline. The push to charter schools and Daniels' war on teachers will erode further the public education system of Indiana. What is expected in Indiana public education in the next 4 years? How can Indiana attract quality employers if our education system churns out lower quality students in all but the affluent areas of the state? How can we help the millions of children underserved by an underfunded public education system? Brian Payne, I think I'll throw that one to you first.
Okay. Well, we have a major initiative at Central Indiana Community Foundation called the College Readiness and Success Initiative. And, you know, change is hard. Change, you know, in every element of change, you have people who are going to be disadvantaged and others who will be advantaged. I mean, that's just the way change is. It favors some and disfavors the others. But I don't think we can. I mean, I'm a big believer we can't continue what we've done in the past. So in this case, we do need to embrace major change and major reform. We at the Central Indiana Community Foundation work very closely with the Department of Education under Tony Bennett's leadership, and we embraced his energy, his charisma, his courage, his political courage, and a lot of his ideas. From what I've read, with the supermajority of the Republicans being more in support of a lot of these concepts, I think we are going to see that that's going to continue, and not being political, we just think that that change is needed in public education, and we're supporting that change.
Well, in dealing with that, though, we're talking about a supermajority, and to some degree, we did deal with an election, though. The argument, and I hear this from a lot of people, is that in the one office that is directly responsible for education, the voters decided they wanted to go another way, or at least slow things down. When we get back from the break, I'd like to talk a little bit more about that, about how obligated we are to follow the voters' directives in that situation. We are talking about the political and public policy landscape here on No Limits. My guests are John Krause, Dave Dressler, and Brian Payne. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the public policy and political landscape in Indiana under a new Pence administration and a second Obama administration. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. My guests are John Krause, who is the Indiana Public Policy Institute director, Dave Dressler, who is head of University of Indianapolis's CEL program, and Brian Payne, who is the president and CEO of the Central Indiana Community Foundation. Right before the break, we were talking about education reform. We got an email from a listener who said that there is concern about the uncertainty there, and I'd sort of framed a question of, you know, what is the system's obligation to respond to, you know, Glenda Ritz's election. I should point out Glenda Ritz is going to be a guest on the show in a couple of weeks. I'll throw that one to David Dressler.
Well, I think Brian's response was appropriate in terms of what people feel in terms of education reform and the changes that are needed in education. I think there's a consensus that we do need to move forward, making sure that students are more successful academically. The question is how we move forward and what forward movement is defined as. You know, we used to have traditional Republican and Democratic positions in education. Mm-hmm. Democrats were aligned with the union pretty solidly, and Republicans were looking at choice and non-government schools and options for kids pretty solidly. But all that has changed a lot recently. Tony Bennett, who is a Republican, former Republican state superintendent, I guess current Republican state superintendent, was a friend of Arne Duncan, who is the Secretary of Education under President Obama. They had a lot of things in common. Choice, charters, performance-based compensation for teachers, these are all things that aren't Republican-oriented anymore, but rather progressive Democrats have made this a part of their agenda also. On the other hand, I think that we've seen Democrats also shift their thinking with regard to the appropriateness of reforms and not just taking the union line. However, I think it's unavoidable to accept the fact that Glenda Ritz did win the election, and she won the election fair and square, did it in a way that we may see future elections campaigns conducted, and that is this could be our first Facebook statewide election that has been successful because she really brought out the rank and file, the educational community and their friends and neighbors and relatives, and this is seen as nationally as mm-hmm. a repudiation of maybe not the the actual reforms that were on Dr. Bennett's agenda, but the way in which those reforms were pursued. His personal style, or at least the style that a lot of people perceived out in the state.
Well, and you've raised a lot of points that, frankly, we probably could spend several hours talking about, not the least of which is that the way she won the campaign, that using Facebook and social media may revolutionize campaign finance and really level the playing field in a way that a lot of the laws didn't even do. We've gotten a couple more emails from listeners that I'd like to get to. One of them takes me to task. A listener named Zach says, you question congressmen to take an anti-government stance, but what other choice do they have? You have to be in the boat if you want to rock it. That's a fair point. thanks for the email, Zach. And then we got another email question from a listener named Mike, who said, I would be interested in your guests commenting on the Indiana legislators wanting to ban gay marriage when it seems to me that the country is swinging in a different direction. How does this affect the brain drain that occurs in Indiana? I'll start with John Krause on that one.
Well, I think it's a question that some might say shouldn't be raised as a top priority. I listened to statements by former Governor Kernan, former Governor Davis, and Mitch Daniels' campaign manager, who was at a Indiana State Chamber of Commerce mm-hmm. function. They were unanimous in saying this is something that we should not be concerning ourselves. There are higher priorities here in Indiana. This is a divisive issue, and if we are going to be a welcoming state and welcoming in terms of new business, new opportunities, it's something that we shouldn't be sending a message out. There are laws on the books, and why do we need to raise this again? You raised a question, issue
John Krause,
earlier about supermajorities.
Mm-hmm.
I think Speaker Bosma and President Pro Tem Long have their hands full mm-hmm. in the General Assembly, because when you have that many as a majority of one party with that many freshmen on board, it's going to be difficult to control all the different factions there, and that's going to be difficult to do.
Yeah, I know there's a school of you know, political scientists who would argue in that situation that a faction of the majority party actually becomes the opposition party to some degree, because all the decisions are made in the caucus room.
And then when Brian was talking about change, one of my staff members have coined the phrase, if you don't change, it doesn't remain the same. And I think that's where we really have to come to grips with in Indiana in a lot of things, whether that's education or that's workforce. I think the whole educational area, K through 12, and higher education and post K through 12, is in for a change because the workplace has changed.
We are talking about public policy and politics under a new Pence administration and a second Obama administration here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Josh, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. Certainly. Your question, please.
Yeah. I just wanted to comment on how I think that Obama has been very successful at motivating the public and getting them excited about his ideas, but I think he has fallen short as a politician when he gets into the really detailed horse trading with the Republicans in Congress. And I wanted to ask the panel, what leader should we look for in our next presidential candidate who could maybe work a little better with some of the politicians we have?
Thanks for the question, Josh. Appreciate it. Well, I'll throw that one, I guess, to Dave Dressler first.
Well, the question is, can a president work with this Congress? The parallels between 1932 and FDR's election after a depression and Herbert Hoover had an unsuccessful run in trying to fix that, and Obama's election as a Democratic president following a Republican president is a stark contrast, because in the first 100 days of FDR's administration, he passed 13 major policies from the Civilian Conservation Corps to the Tennessee Valley Authority. He went off the gold standard. He corrected the banking crisis. He corrected the securities crisis. He did farm supports, which were a brand new concept, and I've forgotten more than I've remembered. Mm-hmm. But that was because the Congress voted, Republicans and Democrats voted for these improvements, these policies, these proposals to fix the economy together. Mm-hmm. And there was a bipartisan effort to do what was best for the country and to turn the country around, and in large part it succeeded. Now, bring us to the present day. If in instead of looking at public policies that help the country succeed, we're looking at, we cannot vote for this because it would be a win for the president, or it would weaken our party, whichever party we're a part of, mm-hmm. as opposed to what's best for the country. It seems to me that back then, and this is historical, but in the past, it has been country first and party second, and it's unavoidable to conclude that now it's party first and country second, or if country at all. And so can a president work with this Congress, with a Congress, under those circumstances without the public coming on board and saying, we won't tolerate this anymore? That's the question that has to be answered.
How much of this is a product? Let me reframe it a little bit for John Krause. Yeah. How much of this is a product also of gerrymandering? I mean, the fact that
they're safe districts. Most of these people are in safe districts.
And they end up basically running and talking to people who agree with them all the time.
And they're running to make sure that they win the primary.
Yeah.
But I just finished Robert Caro's book, the latest edition on Lyndon Johnson. Mm-hmm. And I take the caller's point. In that Obama may project a good mm-hmm. public policy, but as far as the one-on-one retail, he doesn't appear to be comfortable. And where in this book, Johnson was very comfortable in doing the pressing of the flesh and jawboning and talking and getting his point across and truly lobbying. Now, granted, the media with the instantaneous gotcha type of opportunities is changed.
Oh, Lyndon Johnson would not survive.
He would not survive. He has too many skeletons in his closet. But the points there is sometimes you've got to leave the White House, you've got to walk the halls, you've got to go see somebody on their side of the fence and see and talk to them. And I think that's kind of what we're missing. And whether Obama can change and get those qualities, I don't know.
Well, I'd like to transition this now more to the state level and talk, you know, we've talked about supermajorities and the challenges that Speaker Brian Bosma and President Pro Tem David Long will have in terms of dealing with that. What are the challenges the governor is going to have in that situation? A new governor, Mike Pence, who got elected with less than 50% of the vote when, you know, basically the leaders of the two chambers can send the Democrats home basically for the entire session and still do business. Brian Payne.
Well, I think it could. I mean, if the leaders of the House and Senate didn't see eye to eye with the governor, he's in for a tough time. Back to that earlier mm-hmm. question of what the priorities are. I mean, the priorities mm-hmm. in the state have to be education and workforce readiness and talent attraction and retention. I mean, as you know, as successful as Governor Daniels was in so many things as a leader, you know, he basically did not deliver on his number one promise, his number one agenda item 8 years ago, and that was to raise the level of per capita income of the citizens of Indiana. It actually went down. That's a crisis. I mean, that's a crisis mm-hmm. for philanthropy. If more and more people are in poverty, how are we going to deal with that, especially when the state government doesn't want to pay for it? That becomes a crisis for the social sector. So we need to attract the best and create and develop the best and the brightest. And, you know, and if we've got policies, and here's how I think it's going to play out, is that Governor Pence won't have to play the lead in some of these social service policies that will actually make us look potentially unwelcoming to very bright people from around the country, mm-hmm. people who we've been succeeding in drawing to mm-hmm. Indianapolis because they at least perceive Indianapolis as different sometimes than the state, people who we depend on in mm-hmm. Indianapolis for our economy and for change and for positive intellectual leadership. But he can just be reactive. I think his supermajority constituency in the state and Senate will bring it to him, and he'll sign it. He won't have to be the leader of it, mm-hmm. and I think that is going to be using resources and time and energy in a very counterproductive way.
John Krause.
Infrastructure is probably the number one priority the state has to come to grips with. And I don't mean that just in physical infrastructure, it's human capital. The whole continuum of education and workforce development and securing opportunities for young people that are coming through the system today to see opportunities to stay in Indiana or to move here to Indiana. The same regard is Major Moves was a great program, but there is no more money. Mm-hmm. Ironically, because of energy efficiency and the changes of the way we buy vehicles, whether it's electric or propane or some other thing, we are buying fewer gallons of gasoline. Therefore, we don't have as much gasoline tax that was traditionally been funding our streets and roads and bridges. And unless we've got the infrastructure in order to have our cities survive and produce commerce, we're not going to be competitive. And so I think human capital and the physical capital of this state are going to be priorities that we've got to invest in, and that's going to be a priority for this collective administration.
Dave Dressler.
Well, both John and Brian mentioned capital, human capital, and workforce development. One of the very positive things coming out of this election is the fact that both Governor-elect Pence and Superintendent-elect Ritz agree on the importance of career and technical education in Indiana. Mm-hmm. And that's something where they have some common ground. We're excited about that common ground. They're looking at developing education and workforce initiatives on a regional basis. We have a huge skills gap in the state of Indiana, and that is we have a lot of unemployed people and a lot of jobs that are going begging because those people that are unemployed don't have the skills to fill the positions that are available to them. And that's a function of education. That's something that educators need to be attentive to, and it's something that both Superintendent Ritz and Governor Pence will address together. And so those people that are concerned about the state superintendent and the governor not being on the same page on some of the other policy initiatives, with regard to career and technical education, I think we're going to see great advances, and I think those advances will be interpreted into economic development in Indiana communities.
We've gotten an email question from a listener, and if you want to send an email question, do it to nolimits@wfyi.org. This is from Carrie, who says, I am hearing the typical claim that neither left or right are willing to compromise. There is no progressive or left-leaning congressperson who over the past decade has thwarted compromise on the important issues of our time. Name one. We can name numerous Republican legislators whose reputation political pride is based on suppressing democratic processes beginning with voting. To say that both sides do what clearly the right wing is known for doing to thwart governing this nation is not just false equivalency, but it is lazy journalism, and cites Norm Ornstein studies on this, asks you all to comment. Dave Dressler is smiling, so I'll throw that one to you first.
Well, the smile didn't indicate that I had a comment. It may be more a product of the fact that that the listener is strong in their opinions that this is a one-sided roadblock. I do think that both sides bear some responsibility, but I do think that some of the extreme views may tend to be more the new Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, where they're saying it's got to be this way. We take the no tax pledge, that sort of thing. On the other hand, the way Washington works, it takes two to tango, and I don't know that you can define this as a one-sided phenomenon.
Yeah, well, and I'll reframe it ever so slightly because, you know, at the national level on this program, we've had Evan Bayh and Richard Lugar in the past, you know, saying that things had changed in Washington, that there isn't the same level of collegiality. I know here at the state level, you see the same things. I mean, whether you liked it or not, it was 15, 20 years ago, if you went over to the bar at the Columbia Club, you would find Republican and Democratic legislators sitting and eating and drinking together and sharing stories and telling jokes. You just do not see that anymore as much. So when we get back from the break, I hope we can talk a little bit about that and also talk about maybe get some counsel as to how Mike Pence should approach attempting to deal with this legislature, what initiatives he should push. We are talking about the political and public policy landscape here on No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Indiana under a new Pence administration and second Obama administration. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are John Krause, who is Indiana Public Policy Institute Director, Dave Dressler, who is the head of the Center of Excellence in Leadership of Learning at the University of Indianapolis. That's a mouthful, Dave. And Brian Payne, who is President and CEO of the Central Indiana Community Foundation. Well, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the breakdown of kind of collegiality between the two parties and the fact that people wouldn't work across party lines. And then I also tossed out the question, given this kind of fractured system, if you were Mike Pence and coming in as governor, how would you attempt to approach that leadership challenge? Brian Payne, I'll go with you first. I toss you the easy ones.
Yeah, thanks. Well, if I was the new governor, I would try to explain what my priorities are to my colleagues and my associates in the House and Senate, which I'm sure he's done. But I don't have, other than a few sound bites, I don't have a real great understanding of what he's going to try to accomplish. I mean, it's kind of like, well, I want to do what Mitch Daniels is going to do as far as the economy. I want to run an efficient state. I want to cut taxes by 10%. And that's about all I know. I know that I heard Brian Bosma speak at a Chamber of Commerce luncheon recently, and it seems like he and his constituents have a big agenda. It'll be interesting. The one thing I heard Brian Bosma say is, he actually did say this. He basically said, me and my House co-leaders should be getting a lot of the credit that the governor, Daniels, has gotten in the past 8 years. So there seems to be, a sense of wanting to be recognized for the leadership that they've provided, which then could become kind of a battle of who gets the credit, or from some people's perspectives, who should get the blame.
And having spent a fair amount of time over at the legislature, you are hearing that from legislators, that they're getting a little tired of being dictated to by
Mike Pence and Mitch Daniels are both Republicans. But I think that's where the difference is going to be apparent. This is a whole new experience for Mike Pence. He's been a member of Congress, which has been one single person. He's operated a Washington office with maybe 10, 15 people. Mm-hmm. And state government is a rather large operation. Mm-hmm. And it's a management responsibility. Mm-hmm. So he's got to get an understanding of how he can get his team to implement things and also put out brush fires. So it's going to be a learning experience for Mike Pence, and it's going to be a learning experience for the citizens of Indiana, because it's not going to be the same as Mitch Daniels for the last 8 years. And whether you liked it or not, Mitch Daniels had an agenda, and he was rather bold.
Mm-hmm. If I could just add to that, I think that's a great point. I mean, we've studied a lot at Central Indiana Community Foundation the difference between executive leadership mm-hmm. and legislative leadership. Mm-hmm. It's a completely different thing. I mean, in the not-for-profit world, even though I'm the CEO of a rather large foundation, it's not-for-profit world is built around kind of legislative type of influence. You have to influence people. You can't just tell grantees what they're going to do.
You persuade rather than
Mitch Daniels had a lot of experience as being, in his corporate world, of being an executive. And in fact, that was some of the comments, was that, he came in as governor. Some of the interesting mm-hmm. comments from leader of the House, Bosma, about how he came in, thought he could just tell everyone what to do, in the legislative process, and that's not the way it works. There's a legislative system. But he at least understood leadership from an executive perspective. And as John points out, you know, Governor Pence doesn't necessarily have that experience. Is he a natural about that? Maybe he is. We don't know. We'll see.
Something's going to go off.
John Krause,
the train's going to go off the tracks somewhere. You know, it always happens. How does Pence and his team react to that? And so they're going to get tested probably pretty soon. And that's for us to see how it all rolls
tested,
out.
Tested by whom? Tested by the legislative leaders? Tested by...
Tested by everybody, the public, the media, the General Assembly. How do you fix a problem and turn it into an opportunity rather than just have it be a glaring problem?
Did he, I mean, has he made the task more difficult for himself, Dave Dressler? I'll ask this. By when he was campaigning, saying basically I'm just going to continue to be Mitch Daniels, when in fact he's not Mitch Daniels. I'm not saying that pejoratively. I'm just saying that there's an objective.
I don't know if he's made the task more difficult. I think that he has an opportunity. There's not a great deal of expectation at this point. There's not, as Brian was saying, there's not a consensus as to where he stands on the issues, and so he can define his stance on the issues in such a way as to bring some leadership, executive leadership, to the legislative process. So I think he has a tremendous opportunity, and I think a key to that executive experience will be the people he surrounds himself with. His team will be a very important factor in terms of his own success.
And in terms of, he also comes from a media background. He did basically what I do. I'm doing right now, which is host a radio show. I mean, will those communication skills serve him well, John Krause?
I think they will. But governing a state of Indiana is more than sound bites.
Yeah.
So it's going to take a combination. Being a communicator, I think, is a real good asset. But you've got to have a program to communicate. And that's what everyone's saying that we need to hear.
We are talking about the political and public policy landscape here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Hello. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. Your question, please.
Well, why doesn't Congress get it? the partisanship has created a crisis in our country and that nothing gets done. I've known Brian for some time. He and I, until I retired this fall, I was in the same general line of work as he is, a few counties to the north. And I know that Brian and I are smart enough that if we were together in a situation like that, if we had only 4 out of 7 of those items matched, we would work on those 4 to get them done and then worry about the others later. Why don't they understand that?
Thanks very much for the question, Ron. Your cell phone's breaking up a little bit, so I'm going to drop the call and get your question answered. Well, I'll throw that one, I think, to John Krause. I mean, that is a question you hear frequently, which is, you know, if everyone else can see it, that this is not working, why can't they?
Who's the constituency that these people listen to? And it appears as though they're listening to the base that has been solidly defined by a district that they're safe in, and the only thing on their agenda right now is the primary. It's a fight in the primary, and they're not really worried about the general election. So that if you keep speaking to your base, feeding in them the lines that they want to hear, then you're not going to go and be able to deal with some of those tough issues. Because as the caller said, if you have 7 issues and you can agree on 3, and so you sit down and think about how are we going to work on the other 4, that's compromise. And that's mean finding value in each other's position so that you can understand each other's interests to solve the problem and to move it ahead so that everybody wins something. Nobody wins 100%. Nobody loses 100%. But you're moving the ball along. And that's what seems to be missing. The media exacerbate that.
Mm-hmm. If you're accountable to extremists, you're going to act in an extreme way.
Mm-hmm.
And and there's so much self-interest in just, again, in winning. Mm-hmm. It's all about winning. Even President Obama, it was like, he got lambasted for not running a very inspiring campaign, but ultimately he won. So it was all about, you know, it was everything else was forgiven because when you win, everything is forgiven. At the media level, at the media kind of hype, values level. But as I completely agree with John. If you're only, you know, if you're only listening to that small amount of people in your constituency who go to the primaries and who, you know, come to the fundraisers and have an extreme position, then you're just going to listen to them because that's who's going to get you reelected, even though the country's going to hell in a handbasket. You know, it's about self-interest. It's about winning. It's not about principles anymore.
Well, and I come back to the question then of gerrymandering, too, particularly at this level. I thought it was instructive when we watched the fiscal cliff thing, the difference between the vote in the Senate, where you can't gerrymander the seats, was 89-8, but obviously was much different in the House. How much of that, you know, is not just the people, but the system we're using to choose our leadership right now? Dave Dressler.
Well, the vote is a product of where you stand on the issue, but it may be even more important to not be campaigned against in a future primary or a future general election. Our congressmen often vote so that that vote will either be something they can tout in a future election or something that they don't have to defend in a future election. And so people stake out their positions based on what they think. You know, the caller said, why don't they get it? They do get it. They get returned to office. It works. And before they consider public policy, it is re-election. And re-election occurs for these people with these votes. And so it's not a case of them not getting it. It's really more our expectations for the Congress than it is their action.
Well, and to some degree, we here in Indiana, we've got the example of Richard Lugar, clearly, who, you know, lost, as John Krause has said repeatedly here, faced a primary challenge and was, in effect, punished by his party's base because he committed the sin of working with people who disagree with him.
One of the things I think has been a criticism of Dick Lugar's campaign, and he's had 40 years of wonderful leadership in the Senate representing Indiana, was grassroots politics. Did he get out and do the rubber chicken dinners and lunches like he did maybe 25, 30 years ago? So you don't know. The things that's striking me now is that this conversation is merely reinforcing the already agreed-on perception out there that things are pretty well messed up and the opportunity is far over the horizon and we're not going to see it. I think if we develop an attitude that we want some change, we want some people to work together, we are not going to be abated by the sound bites as we have been so frequently. It's not going to change overnight, but the power to change the situation is in our own hands, and we've got to find a way to do that and to express that rather than just, woe is me and the system doesn't work.
We are talking about the political and public policy landscape here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Rev, welcome to the program.
Thank you. There was an analogy drawn here with respect to FDR's election and so on. Is there perhaps an analogy going back even further with the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which went on and on and on, and then it satisfied no one? Then there was the Compromise of 1850. Then 10 years later, a very divisive man got elected to President, A. Lincoln, and the war came, as he said, and then soon thereafter, there were 700,000 American dead. Please comment. Thank you.
Will do. Thanks, Rev. Thanks for the call. Well, Dave, I think you were the one who was, Dave Dressler, you were talking about FDR. I guess, you know.
Well, I hope history does not repeat itself with regard to the Civil War.
The Civil War was not a happy time.
No,
for
not
us.
A happy time, and I don't think that's where we're headed. So there is there have been some improvements since then in terms of how we develop public policy and how we address our grievances. But The fact is, there are many parallels in our history to our current situation. Mm-hmm. The difference is the degree of rancor that we're witnessing, and we're witnessing it because we have instant access through the media. And that causes cynicism with the public, and that cynicism turns people off to government, and it's a shame because government is a noble profession when practiced properly.
Well, and I think the history professors or teachers out there probably would chide me if I didn't point out, too, that sometimes deferring difficult decisions is not the worst possible outcome. And, you know, using Rev's examples of 1820 and 1850, if we'd fought a civil war in 1820, it's an open question whether we would have been able to pull the country back together, whether there would have been a decisive enough outcome. So perhaps by deferring things 30 or 40 years, it wasn't such a bad thing. We've also gotten an email question from a listener named Matt who says, what should Indiana schools be doing differently to prepare students for the changing workforce? Brian Payne.
Well, I just got out of a meeting this morning with Jason Cloth, who's the deputy mayor of education for Indianapolis, and again, looking at all the various ways to bring in more talent to the teaching ranks. I know there's a lot of talent out there, but how do you open it up? I mean, that first call or that first email that we had about the gentleman whose wife teaches art in the second grade and kind of lamenting the fact that people could now come into the school as a teacher without going through the kind of more traditional processes. Well, the fact is we're not turning out science teachers at the rate that we need them, but we could go out and get scientists and let them come into the teaching profession without making them go to 4 years of you know, traditional school. That's a good reform. So it's about bringing in more talent, opening this up to people who have different resources to bring, more ideas to bring, and I think an open system is a good system. I remember 15 years ago, I lamented and was very upset about this idea. I mean, I'm a public school kid, so this idea that you could give, vouchers to people to go to private school. 15 years ago, I thought that was a horrible idea. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good idea now because we just need to create as much competition, as much open sourcing. You know, with this thing that Jason's talking about in Annapolis is that we need all these high-performing opportunities throughout Indianapolis. So whatever we can do to create that excellent opportunity for every student, And we have to get there with many, many different strategies, but a lot of them are new strategies, and I think we need to pursue a lot of those new strategies.
Is that a point where we're getting close on time here, but is that a point that gets overlooked in the education debate, that really what a lot of the reformers are talking about is not so much emphasizing that they know the way right now. They're calling for more pilots and experimentation.
Right. No one knows everything that's going to work out, but this idea of, you know, that definition of insanity, if you do this, everything you've always done, why would you expect different results? And we're at a point in education with the crisis that we need to try new things because the way we've been approaching it for the last 30 years hasn't worked. So we got to open this up and try some bold new ideas.
I'm afraid that's actually going to have to be the last word. I want to thank all three of you, John Krause, Dave Dressler, and Brian Payne, for joining us today on No Limits. Thank you very much for spending this time with us. We will be back 2 weeks from now when we talk with Glenda Ritz, who is the new state education leader, about many of these same issues. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.